Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Heroin use in Ohio has been declared a public health crisis by state lawmakers and by the state. The problem often starts with prescription opiates. For example, between 1997 and 2010, the per capita dosage of opioids increased from 7 pills per person to 67 pills per person. That's a 1,000% increase, according to the Ohio State Board of Pharmacy. Coming up, we'll hear from an addict about her descent into addiction and her recovery, and from the head of a local organization dedicated to helping women overcome substance abuse for the long run. Right now, we're going to talk to someone close to the problem of heroin addiction who decided that in order to understand the problem better, he needed to meet addicts directly. Joining us now by phone is Butler County Prosecutor Michael Mosier. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for paying attention to this issue.
What prompted you to take this approach to educating yourself?
Well, the buzzword right now is that there's an epidemic of heroin abuse, and I see it every single day in my office, and I've seen it for years, and 85% of every case I handle has some drug component to it. So it's not news to me that we've got an epidemic. I'm just in a position now where I want to try to do something to stop the next generation from getting involved, number one, and educate myself in that effort on how these folks got into it in the first place. I want to know what the last sober moment was before a young person decided to shove that needle in their arm. So I want to talk to them. I want to hear their stories, and I'm doing that, and I'm hearing their stories. It's very enlightening.
You're not talking to people that you're actually prosecuting. You put out the word that you wanted to have these conversations with people who are not yet or had not currently in trouble with the law, right?
They're not in the system yet. Okay. I could have gone to the county jail and talked to 100 addicts. That would have been very easy. Or I could have gone to our drug court and I could have talked to the graduates of that system or the folks that are involved in that system. That would have been the easy part. But I want to get somebody who is taking the initiative to answer the call to educate me on how they got into this so that we can show young people how not to do it.
So what have you learned so far? I know you've just started to have the interviews. First of all, what's been the response to your query?
Well, the response has been tremendous. We've already had over 125 calls to the hotline. We have current users, recovering users, people that want to get treatment. And by the way, this is not something that the initiative is not to try to cure those folks that are already addicted. I can give them information on where services are available, and I do that. But the initiative is actually to gain the understanding to how to keep people from getting into this as opposed to getting them out of it once they're in it. But the response has been terrific.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Butler County Prosecutor Michael Mosier about his new quest to learn more about the incidence of addiction. He's put out a query to the public asking for addicts to meet with him and do an interview with him to learn more about how they got addicted in the first place. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. As a prosecutor, are you educated very much about drug addiction, given that it is so integral to so many crimes these days?
Well, I would be nuts if I wasn't agitated by it. I mean, this is deplorable, frankly. I mean, that we have crime that is now focused on obtaining money to acquire heroin and other addictive substances. That's what is the motivating force for a lot of the crime that I deal with every day. You know, I'm not decrying that we no longer have the old-fashioned crook who's just stealing for self-gain. These folks are stealing so that they can supply a habit, and I'm learning that it's not just so much for the high that they are going to experience. It's so that they do not get drug sick. They will apportion their dosage, if you will, throughout the day so that they don't get drug sick. It's not so that they can go fly high as a kite and feel good.
Mm-hmm.
To them, feeling good is not feeling sick. And that's one of the things that I'm learning. One of the other things I've learned is in the cross-section of the people that I've talked to, the commonality, the threads are that there's not available services for people that don't have insurance, that can't afford treatment. They are just out of luck. there are indigent beds available, but there has to be an opening for those indigent beds before they can get treatment. And in the meantime, what are they going to do? Do you think they're just going to sit back and wait for somebody to throw a bed at them or make the funds available? No. What they're going to do is they're going to go out, unfortunately, commit crimes, involve themselves in the drug trade or traffic or the criminality to obtain the drugs. And then I'm going to have an indictment, and I'm going to be prosecuting them, and the taxpayers are going to be paying for all manner of things mm-hmm. with respect to that criminality. That's deplorable.
Do you think that by learning more about it in this way, that it could change how you prosecute?
Look, I believe that every prosecutor in the state of Ohio is a compassionate person. Mm-hmm. We understand why these people are involved. We understand, I believe, that our goal should be to prosecute the drug dealers, the manufacturers, the people that are bringing this stuff into the state, the people that are making it available for that first opportunity that ends up in a lifelong problem. I don't like, and I never have liked, prosecuting sick people. But sick people can do some pretty horrific things, and when they do those horrific things, they are going to be prosecuted and they are going to go to prison. That's a reality. It is not crime by reason of insanity with respect to drug usage. There is a choice involved, but the choice is one of those gripping things that they have to feed that habit. The monster got them, and the monster isn't letting go. That's the problem.
What are you learning about why people use heroin in the first place?
Because it's cheap. Right now, if they can't get their pills, the state medical board, by the way.
So it starts with pills.
In many instances, I'm learning, it's the gateway drug is not necessarily heroin. You always hear that. Well, we've got to stop the marijuana. We've got to stop the marijuana so they don't get onto the heroin. The people I've talked to so far, and I always sort of bought into that idea that the gateway drugs are the way to the heroin. But I'm learning that it is, in many cases, people that are addicted to painkillers from some work-related injury, some accident that they had, some car deal that occurred where they hurt their back, and they're treated until their insurance runs out. When their insurance runs out, their doctor runs out. And that's just business. And it's unfortunate that business ends up with somebody that then looks for pills on the black market, and when they can't get them there, they go to the cheapest thing that is available right now, and right now heroin is king, and it's coming from Mexico. Unfortunately, we need to do something along the borders to keep this stuff out of our country. I'm asking the government to do more with respect to interdiction. Everybody will tell you in law enforcement that are understaffed on that, both in the state of Ohio and on the border. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the heck Mexico is doing down there, but I hope they're doing something for poppy eradication. I believe there's some efforts in the Sierra Madre Mountains and places where this stuff comes from. But a lot of the heroin now in our country is coming from Mexico. Mm-hmm. Used to be the Golden Triangle and Burma and those countries over there, and Afghanistan, our soldiers chasing the Taliban around in poppy fields because we don't want to disrupt their farming industry over there. That would be even worse for the propagation of Taliban interests. So the bottom line is, it's got to be a cooperative effort, but I've got to get to the root cause here, mm-hmm. and that is to understand how these people are getting into it so I can talk to young people about staying out of it.
You just were talking about cutting off the supply lines of the drug. Yeah. What about the root cause, getting addicted in the first place because of something completely unrelated to anything criminal, some kind of ache or pain, the drugs were prescribed, the doctor says, I can't give you any more. Is there any responsibility on the medical community to follow through with patients that have become addicted to painkillers?
Well, one of the first rules of medicine is do no harm. Mm-hmm. And when people become addicted through the desire of a doctor to give comfort to a patient, the second thing that doctors want to do is keep you from having pain. Mm-hmm. And they become very, very good at that with respect to the medicines that they prescribe. But then when the money runs out, the doctors do not see themselves as being a charitable enterprise that they have to keep these people on or to wean them off, even though there's no funds available for that to occur. And these people then turn to illegal drugs, unfortunately. That's a large part of it, by the way. But there's a lot of other, that's just one thread. Mm-hmm. There's many other threads. There's addictive personalities I'm hearing about. There's people that have social pressures. A group of cheerleaders, they were all on drugs. And they just had a reunion recently after 20 years, and they were still on drugs. And the one person who wasn't on drugs went back to that little group and ended up back on drugs again because she met up with her friends, and they're all back onto it again. There's some really sad stories, by the way.
How many people have you met with?
Well, I've only met with half a dozen so far, but that was over the past 4 days, and it's been quite an experience.
You want to use their stories to ward off addiction in younger people. What is the you mentioned these girls who started it as cheerleaders.
Sure. This is a broader initiative. You know, just my education is not going to do anybody any good. I mean, it does make them feel, by the way, and legitimately so, that somebody in a position of authority, and after all, I'm at the top of the food chain before you get to a judge in law enforcement,
they
do appreciate the fact that somebody actually does have a genuine interest in how they got into it without being judgmental and without blaming them. Yes, I blame them for making a bad choice, but my God, we all make bad choices in life. Does that mean they have to suffer a life sentence of castigation from us that are not addicted?
What about the incarceration, the rules, or the life of incarceration of an incarcerated person? Often the sentencing times aren't long enough to get anybody into an adequate treatment program. There's been a lot of talk about that. What do you make of that problem?
Well, I mean, I have to have a better understanding of that problem, frankly. I'm on the prosecution end of this. I'm not really on the treatment side of it. Our drug court in Butler County has had amazing results, many graduating classes of people that have had the alternative to prison or jail to go into our drug court system. And it is taken very seriously, and the people that work with that do a very good job of finding the facilities and the available beds and really working their hearts out to help these people. So I feel that there is the framework for getting things done. But just throwing the key away and hoping that they're going to somehow get out of it by being locked up in a prison somewhere. By the way, I'm hearing stories about how available drugs can be in the prison system also, which is kind of disheartening.
Mm-hmm. Well, Michael Mosier, I hope to talk to you again and catch up and see what's happening with your efforts.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the interest that you're showing, and I look forward to talking to you again, and I'll hopefully have some results on how this is proceeding.
All right. That's the Butler County Prosecutor Michael Mosier. He's been interviewing heroin addicts to find out why they got started in the first place and maybe how to use their stories to prevent others from following that same path. We'll continue our conversation about the heroin addiction problem in Ohio. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Many lawmakers and Governor John Kasich have characterized heroin use in Ohio as an epidemic. It often starts with prescription opioids, more often than not. And those opioids are associated with more fatal overdoses than any other prescription or illegal drug, including cocaine and heroin combined. Here to talk about the larger problem is the director of the Governor's Cabinet Opiate Action Team, Orman Hall. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here, Ann.
So what is the connection between prescription opiates and heroin? What do we know about how many people start with legal prescriptions from doctors and end up committing crimes to get another fix of heroin?
Well, what a great question. What we know, by the way, is that almost all persons who are addicted to heroin start out with prescription opiates, especially over the span of the last several years. And historically, if you look at overdoses in our state, If you go back to 1979, which I realize was a long time ago, there were
I remember it very well.
Actually, I do too, unfortunately. but there were in 1979 there were fewer than 200 people in our state that died from any unintentional drug overdose. Now, if you flash forward to 2012, the last year that we have complete information about overdoses in our state, there were 1,914 overdoses, a dramatic shift in the number of people dying from drug overdoses. The Ray State University just completed a pretty intensive study of heroin and opiate-related overdoses in 23 counties around our state. And what they found was that about 86% of overdoses are associated with either prescription opiates or heroin. And what most people don't understand is that prescription opiates and heroin affect the brain in precisely the same way. So heroin is really just a part of a continuum of opiate-related addiction problems that our state is experiencing.
What? How are doctors prepared to deal with this problem? How do they prepare their patients? Do they tell them, this is an opioid, you might become addicted to it, you might have a problem, we need to talk about how to wean you off of it?
You know, I don't know that those conversations are occurring as frequently as they need to be occurring. And by the way, this is not just an Ohio problem. If you look at information from the International Narcotics Control Board, what their data shows is that in 2010, with about 4.5% of the world's population, the United States consumed 99% of the world's supply of hydrocodone, more than 80% of the world's supply of oxycodone, and 61% of all opiates produced in the world are consumed by Americans. So our healthcare system's use, not just Ohio, but the American healthcare system's use of prescription opiates is excessive. It is, I think, in many ways unprecedented.
Is it just because we have more access to it? Is it part of our wealth that is a function of this?
You know, I think there are multiple factors. In the mid 90s, there was some incomplete research that suggested that people could be treated with prescription opiates that in ways that would not result in addiction and overdose. And what we know now is that that research was incomplete. So there was a tremendous amount of activity based on well-intended but misinformed prescribing practice change that was based on incomplete and erroneous research. And what we're seeing now, we are bearing the results of the unintended consequences of practice pattern changes that occurred almost 20 years ago.
So that's why we're seeing such an increase statewide now.
We're beginning to see the use of prescription opiates in our state decline.
Okay.
Now we still have tremendous amount of work that needs to be done, but through the efforts of our governor, who has made this one of his most important causes. Mm-hmm. We've engaged the healthcare system. We have recently introduced a set of guidelines that establish a threshold at which point physicians and other practitioners are expected to take a look at those people that they're treating to make sure that they're not treating someone with an addiction disorder. So those guidelines were recently rolled out. There were guidelines around the use of prescription opiates in our healthcare system, and as a result of those efforts, we're beginning to see the use of prescription opiates in our healthcare system decline, but there is, again, more work that needs to be done. Unfortunately, what we're seeing is a significant number of people who are at a point in their addiction where they can no longer afford prescription opiates move to heroin, mm-hmm. which is a much less expensive and in many communities a much more available form of the same addiction that's available to them. And it's a much more dangerous and lethal form of addiction than the prescription opiates because we can't always predict the dose strength.
Mm-hmm.
And because it is so inexpensive, use tends to escalate dramatically in a very short period of time.
And unless people are misguided about this, when much more available in some communities than other, you know, we did a show a year or so ago about the problem in Worthington. This is not necessarily, this is, doesn't know necessarily any socioeconomic boundaries.
That is absolutely correct. This form of addiction knows no boundaries. That is a great way to put it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking right now to Orman Hall. He's the director of Governor Kasich's Opiate Action Team, right?
That's close enough. That's good.
Okay. Loretta in Cleveland, you're on the air. Welcome, Loretta.
Oh, well, thank you, and good morning. I've been trying to formulate exactly how to even propose my question. But I'm wondering, where is the program for people addicted to crack?
Well, let's ask Orman Hall, is crack?
Let me just throw it all out there while it's on my mind, because I don't know if I could formulate it. The reason why I asked is because it looks like a racist color-coded program where whites that mostly use heroin are getting a pass. Heroin is a punishable crime by jail, and we're locking up black people who use crack, which has decimated the inner cities for at least 25 years now, and I don't even buy the opiate argument, because heroin has been around for at least 75, 80 years, where it has become addicted. I mean, we've lost who? Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin. Opiates weren't around then, and people weren't using opiates to feed their heroin addiction. And I just think that we need something for the crack-addicted people. And if this is the case, and if it's working with the heroin, why are we still locking up people with crack, and why are we not giving them a pass as we are the heroin-addicted people?
Let me ask you, Loretta, why do you think people who are addicted to heroin are getting a pass? What do you mean by that?
I think they're getting a pass because they should be in jail.
Well, what makes you think they're not in jail? That's what I want to...
Well, I haven't seen any numbers to say how many of these people who are on the program are incarcerated.
Okay,
and
well,
the way he sounds is it's an outpatient program, is the way it's being put out there.
Okay, well,
and
let's ask
that
Orman.
Is the case,
okay, let's ask Orman Hall. Orman Hall, can you address that? First of all, we were hearing about crack 20 years ago. And cocaine addiction 20 years ago, and now it's heroin. And I think you said that it's the increased access to opiate prescription drugs that led to the increased addiction to heroin, right?
That is correct. Okay. And by the way, I'm very sympathetic to the caller's
it's confusing.
Position. That we have historically in our society, not just in Ohio, but in our society, used incarceration from the standpoint of dealing with addiction disorders, it has proven to be ineffective, and we do have a disproportionate number of minorities in our prisons,
right.
And we are working on that issue, and there's certainly more work that needs to be done. But the point that I would make in regards to the opiate and heroin problem, if you go back to the late 1970s and early 1980s, when cocaine and crack epidemic was in full bloom, there were certainly significant amounts of criminal-related activity, but we did not have the overdose deaths that we are currently seeing as a result of the opiate epidemic. And from my perspective, that is why we need to move so urgently on the opiate front.
So the overdose is, by and large, it's heroin or opiate-related?
It is.
Okay.
Again, referring back to the Right State study that was recently produced for those 23 counties that I just mentioned. In those 23 counties that included Montgomery County, 86% of all unintentional drug overdoses were associated with either prescription opiates or heroin.
All right, Loretta, I hope that helped answer your question. If you have anyone else out there who has a question or comment, we welcome them. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So this change of policy by way of this set of guidelines about prescription and prescribing opiates, has that led to the increase in the rise of heroin use?
You know, that's an interesting question, and there is a line of reasoning that would suggest that that's the case. My belief is that it's more complicated. And if you look at from an economic dynamic standpoint, the cost of prescription opiates is about $1 per milligram. So a 30-milligram Percocet sells for about $30 on the street. Heroin, on the other hand, is about 10 cents per milligram. A standard dose of heroin, which comes in a balloon, on average is about 100 milligrams, and it's about $10. So that's 10 cents as opposed to $1. It's one-tenth the cost. And I think what we're seeing is a significant number of people who are rapidly moving through their addiction who need larger and larger amounts of opiates in order to meet their addiction, transitioning from prescription opiates to heroin. It's not so much that prescription opiates are less available. They are somewhat less available, but it has more to do with the fact that we have people reaching a critical stage in their disease that that has resulted in them needing more than what they can afford in the prescription opiate form.
Butler County Prosecutor Michael Mosier made an interesting observation that these people aren't out partying with heroin. They're trying to stay out of pain.
Exactly. At some point, they're no longer chasing a high. They're just trying to feel normal. There's a young man that has traveled with the governor that talks about his sort of descent into opiate addiction. He was an honor student at The Ohio State University, and his introduction to opiate addiction was recreational use of Percocets. So in the very beginning, he used one-fourth of a 30-milligram pill every other day. By month three, he was using a 30-milligram pill every day by himself. By month eight, he was using 150 milligrams, and he needed 150 milligrams to feel normal. So that was, at that point, a $150 a day habit. And at that point, he switched from prescription opiates to heroin. And by month 11, he was using 15 bags of heroin. That is 1,500 milligrams of heroin. And all of that transpired in an 11-month period.
Is heroin difficult to kick? Is it especially difficult, or is it just opiates in general are difficult to get off of?
Well, again, prescription opiates and heroin affect the brain in the same way,
right.
And they are, as a class of drugs, they are probably the most difficult addiction to overcome. But there, you know, that that's an important point, and everyone needs to understand that. But one of the things that we have. We also have medications and interventions for opiate addiction that aren't available for other forms of addiction. What we know from national research and from our experience here in Ohio is that medication-assisted treatment using medications like Vivitrol, Suboxone, and Methadone can be highly effective in treating people who are motivated to be in recovery.
Can you tell us about what's called the overdose antidote, Naloxone?
Absolutely. Naloxone is what is known as an opiate antagonist. Essentially, what it does is once it is administered, it displaces the prescription opiate or the heroin from the receptor sites in the brain that are being affected, and the person immediately is in precipitated withdrawal. It is an important tool that needs to be available, widely available to people who are addicted, their family members, and to first responders. And if we can get that form of medication more available in our state, I am completely convinced that we're going to save a number of lives in Ohio.
Was it a legislation pending, or was it passed that would give family members access to it?
There is legislation that has recently passed, and we are currently working. The administration is currently working on ways to make naloxone more available in a manner that's consistent with the legislation.
How does having an opiate action task force change the paradigm in Ohio? What's the long-term mission of this task force?
Well, and that's a great question too. Essentially what we're doing, I think one of the governor's basic premises in terms of how he operates as an administrator is that historically, state government, big government in general, tends to operate in silos. And what we're attempting to do with the opiate cabinet is to make sure that within state government, that those major state departments that own a part of this problem, the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, the Department of Corrections, the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Health, the Department of Aging, that all of these departments are working in concert and that we're working together to make sure that we have an integrated solution for a very complicated problem.
Attorney General Mike DeWine last year established his own heroin unit to assist communities. He said the same thing, that many programs will have to break down their silos to work together on this problem. How is that reflected in your action team? I mean, are you working with the Attorney General too?
Absolutely. You know, and by the way, the Attorney General is doing really important groundbreaking work around our state, and including a number of opiate forums to make sure that people have a better understanding of the nature and scope of this problem. And the governor's office has been represented in virtually all of those forms.
And one of the things that Michael Mosier from Butler County said he wanted to do as prosecutor was get people out into the community, addicts out, who can tell people, particularly young people, about addiction, to stop them from getting into it in the first place. But if so many of the addiction issues are coming from prescription drugs to begin with, how do you make that connection with people? It seems like it's a medical community problem.
Well, it is certainly a medical community problem, but one of the things that gives me great hope, if you track and monitor adolescent substance use, what we know is that when adolescents believe a substance to be not harmful, they're more likely to use. And over the span of the last couple of years, the percentage of adolescents who report prescription opiates to be dangerous, that they believe that they're dangerous, has increased dramatically. And as a result, the number of frequent users of prescription opiates has declined by 50% over the span of the last 2 years among school-age adolescents. So I think that we're beginning to see I don't want to say the end of this problem, because we certainly have record numbers of people dying from prescription opiates and heroin. But from the standpoint of closing that pipeline down, making sure that we have fewer adolescents who are engaging in first use, I think we're beginning to see that change. And by the way, the governor's office is also championing. It has also put together another really important initiative called Start Talking. What we know is that when parents talk about addiction-related issues to their children, that those children are about 50% less likely to use. So I think in the very early stages of all of this, we need to make sure that children and adolescents have a clear understanding of what's at stake and how dangerous prescription opiates are and what they can lead to. And I think we're beginning to make real progress in that area.
You're listening. Orman Hall, I want to thank you for joining us today.
It has been my pleasure and honor.
Orman Hall, he's director of Governor Kasich's Opiate Action Task Force. We'll continue our conversation about heroin addiction in Ohio. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Heroin use in Ohio has been declared a public health crisis, but often the stories from the addicts themselves get lost in the coverage of the problem. Joining us now is the CEO of Amethyst, a women and family-focused addiction treatment program in Columbus, Ginny O'Keefe, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Misty Ward. She's a recovering heroin addict and a member of the Amethyst program. Welcome to the show, Misty.
Thanks for having me.
Misty Ward, you've been in recovery from heroin addiction since December 2012. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How did you initially get involved with the drug yourself?
Well, just as you all have been talking about on the program, I started with an injury. I got prescribed prescription opiates, and from there on the progression. It took me a little bit longer, though. My progression kind of happened over the course of, I'd say, like 5 or 6 years of taking the pills and then eventually graduating up to heroin.
Were you cut off from the pills at a certain point?
Basically, I was on the pills, and then as my tolerance grew, the pills that the doctors was giving me wasn't enough. So then I started to buy them off the streets as well as the doctors. Then it got to a point, you know, doctors catch on eventually, and it was basically all buying them on the street. And as my tolerance grew and grew, basically it was just I had didn't have enough money to keep my addiction under control,
so with
therefore
pills.
Therefore I had to switch to a cheaper substance, which heroin was the one.
I was talking to Orman Hall about this a lot, and I tried to get at it. Did your doctor ever talk to you about the possibility of addiction?
Not at all. I feel as though when you go into the doctor's office, a lot of times they just throw these drugs at you and they don't even give you an inclination of what can happen.
Ginny O'Keefe, I was wondering about Amethyst. It's a well-known program in the community. When did the heroin addiction problem start to percolate to the point where you realized it was a really big problem?
Sure. Probably most of us around the state, the women's treatment programs, we have a big network. So I would say in the last 3 years,
really,
we saw our populations in the women's program start to change from maybe 35 to 40 year olds, poly addiction. In the last 3 years, they have radically changed for all of us to the 18 to 23, 24 year olds, white women, and addicted to the painkillers.
Not a poly addiction.
No. Well, I mean, everybody, you know, nobody uses just one thing, but the drug of choice or the drug of last use at this point would be prescription drugs and then the heroin.
And have you seen a pattern when you learn and discover what their path to it was? Is that very typical that people started taking it as a painkiller for a legitimate pain?
I think we see both. The one that concerns me is that these are babies, as far as I'm concerned. They're so young. And when I talk to them many times, their mothers also use prescription drugs because, you know, they're probably 40.
Mm-hmm.
And so they may have seen mom use so that they have experimented too. And that one really troubles me because then the young ones are having babies who can be addicted. So we're really impacting three generations of women.
Misty, when the doctor gave you drugs to kill the pain, you weren't curious about it. I mean, you've kind of grown up in a society where these opiates have been part of everyday life. 20 years ago, that wasn't the case even.
Yeah, I trusted my doctors. They said that I needed to take this medication. And at first I took it as prescribed. Actually, for a really long time, I took it as prescribed. Then one of my friends just told me, like, you know, if you take a couple more of those, you're going to feel really good. And that's kind of like where it took off. And I was just off to the races, off and running.
And what about the heroin? Some people are saying that the reason the problem is so great is because how cheap heroin is, how easy it is to get. Is it really that easy to get?
It is super easy to get. It's everywhere right now, and it's really cheap. That's exactly why I had to switch from the painkillers to the heroin. I mean, your tolerance grows and it doesn't work anymore, and you don't have a choice at that point. It's either you do it or you're sick, and that sickness is worse than any feeling in the entire world.
What's it like?
Imagine the worst flu that you've ever had and times it by 1,000.
And that's what you're medicating after a while, is to get rid of that.
Yeah, and it's not even getting high anymore. It's just totally to feel normal. I had to do it to get out of bed to function as a normal human being. If I didn't, I couldn't even move. I couldn't function at all.
What finally inspired you to get help?
I had to suffer a lot of consequences before I actually got help. I have 3 children. They were removed from my custody. That was not enough. In October of 2012, my mom passed away as a direct result of this disease. And I think that that kind of really woke me up. On the day she passed away, my grandma told me, I thought that that was going to be you. I thought I would get this phone call, but I thought it would be you. And, you know, that just kind of really impacted me. And I knew at that point that I would die if I didn't do something about it.
Ginny O'Keefe, we had a caller from Cleveland, Loretta, who said, why aren't we spending as much time worrying about a largely African-American community that went through the huge and still is suffering from the ramifications of crack addiction from 20 years ago? Do you, Orman Hall from the direct, he's the director of the Governor Kasich's Opiate Action Task Force, said that that's because people weren't necessarily dying from it at the rate they are heroin. How do you compare the two epidemics?
Well, I kind of lived through both of them.
Right.
So, and I'm a recovering person myself. So years ago, it was alcohol. If you remember Ken Burns' big documentary about prohibition and
right.
all the things they were calling us then, a nation of drunkards. Well, I think we just keep finding a new substance to deal with whatever it is we're trying not to feel. I think that it is a very difficult question. There is still plenty of crack cocaine use. It depends on what part of the state you're in.
Okay.
So I think it's that it's getting the most attention. I agree with Orman that it is because of the deaths. It's more in your face. But certainly we must not lower our reserve to make sure that we do not deal with the other substances, because I'm an addict. I'll just keep switching.
Is the state doing enough? And not just, I'm not necessarily talking about the Opiate Action Task Force, but as a whole, when it comes to the incarceration practices and the lack of treatment in prisons and jails for this, the impossibility of it, because treatment takes a while.
Well, absolutely. I mean, when I started, you had 21 days and you were supposed to be well, which didn't work. So, I mean, definitely they need a long period of time. We really have to pay attention to making sure that there are more funds for treatment. They're really, in Columbus, there's not very much treatment available anymore, at least not long term.
Why not anymore?
It's funding. I mean, there have been funding cuts over the years, and it just is not there. I don't think there's a political will across the country. Ohio has been very good in trying to find dollars, but we have to figure out a way. For the first time in my history, we have a champion at the State House in Representative Sprague. He has made it his mission to find money for treatment for the opiate addiction, and has really been responsible for a whole bunch of legislation that's putting money back into the system for treatment and for sober housing. So that, to me, is going to begin a trend. I think he is educating people about what the needs are.
The mental health community was worried recently that funding for mental health care was being taken to manage addiction treatment. It seems like the two factions or should not be at odds with each other. Should money be coming from mental health treatment to go to addiction treatment?
That really is not exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at the budgets with the mid-biennium review, it really wasn't taking money in the same way that I believe it's been described. It was kind of moving it around. There just isn't enough to go around. Mental health has been around much longer than we, so they really have a head start in the funding. We're way behind in our field. We've been underfunded for years.
Do you think there's maybe some silos going up where there shouldn't be, that often mental health issues are related to addiction issues?
Well, addiction is a disease of the brain. Mm-hmm. First of all, we have to recognize that and stick with it. It's not something we did to ourselves, and it's not a choice.
Right.
So I think it's. I think we are still getting over some of that. Still, the stigmas, both ways.
Okay.
But I think we have a greater understanding that oftentimes they are linked. There is, you know, comorbid. What we see with the women from a mental health standpoint is the enormous amount of. Trauma, physical and sexual abuse, and often how that is linked with the addiction you might start using because of that. We have work to do. The department, the new department, OMAS, I think they're doing a really great job of trying to bring things together and have people work more and more closely together. They're working it.
David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David. Hello, David. I'm sorry, David. Okay.
I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you fine.
Okay, thanks for having me. So I'll try to be brief.
Okay.
I have a friend who has been taking oxycodone, and he's been doing it recreationally, but then just recently been up to 2 a day, and he's to the point now where he's just taking it just to feel normal, like you guys were saying earlier.
Mm-hmm.
He's recently found the Suboxone, the synthetic opiate that helps with withdrawal. And he likes that. He really wants to stop. But the problem is he can't find that as readily on the streets as he can the oxycodone. And he doesn't want to jump through the hoops of seeing a professional, seeing a physician, being labeled, you know, an addict and all these things. He really wants to kick it. He wants to, you know, find these Suboxone. But like I said, it's hard to find them. I just want to say one more quick thing.
Okay.
I think it's hard. A lot of people blame the physicians, but their hands are kind of tied. I mean, they have to treat this pain, and especially with the chronic pain people, that your cancer patients,
okay.
things like that. You know, they have to treat this pain, and I think the subjectivity of pain is just really hard for a physician to treat. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Right.
And any help with my buddy's Suboxone. Dylan, I really appreciate it.
All right. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Ginny O'Keefe?
Well, Suboxone does work. But the number of physicians, how many people they can handle on their caseload, if you will, is limited. I think it's to 100. So something has to happen with that so that there's more ability.
But he wants to get it on the street.
Yeah,
do you think? Do you recommend that?
No.
You need more, Misty Ward. You need more than just the pill.
Yeah, Suboxone is, you know, a good thing to help with opiate addiction. I believe, but it can also be abused as well.
Okay.
Just like any other substance, it can be abused, and it needs to be administered under the supervision of a doctor. And there are also facilities. And one thing that we practice in recovery is the fact that you can't do this alone. It's not something that you can do by yourself. You need the support of other people that have been through what you have been through to help you get through this. So I certainly wouldn't recommend trying to do it on your own ever, because it's just a failure thing. And as far as the stigma of being, you know, labeled an addict, trust me, if you can catch it early, because it's only going to get worse, and you're only going to go through a lot more pain and misery rather than worried about what you're going to be labeled, because the consequences that you're going to suffer are going to be far greater.
David sounds like a good friend, but his friend needs more than that. Okay, Ginny O'Keefe, CEO of Amethyst, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
And Misty Ward, thanks to you as well for telling your story. We really appreciate your candor.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks as well to the staff, especially Emmy Beach, who produced this show. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, my production assistants Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Julia Hyder, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.